So without any further ado, let me introduce our first speaker, who is Audette Exel. In 1995, the World Economic Forum dubbed her a global leader of tomorrow, one of a select few chosen because they're the most innovative, enterprising and socially minded men and women under the age of 40 who are pushing boundaries and rethinking the world around them. Audette is the founder of the Adara Group, which consists of two Australian corporate advisory businesses whose sole purpose is to support Adara's non-profit international development group, which funds programs that improve health and education for women, children and communities in need. Audette balances her work in combating poverty with her work as a corporate lawyer specialising in international finance. She's a director of Suncorp. She was formerly managing director of one of Bermuda's three banks, which made her one of the youngest women in the world to have run a publicly listed bank. She was also at one point the chairman of the Bermuda Stock Exchange. In 2013, she was awarded an Order of Australia for services to humanity in Uganda and Nepal. A year later, Forbes named her a hero of philanthropy. And in 2015, Audette was inducted into the Australian Businesswoman's Hall of Fame. Last year, Philanthropy Australia dubbed her Australia's leading philanthropist. She's quite an underachiever. I also hear she has a penchant for children's stories, and she was very nervous about speaking today, which I'm sure she'll explain a bit more, but don't worry, I've told her to just imagine you all naked, so she'll be right. Please welcome Audette Exel.
Thanks, Emma. Thank you so much, and good morning, everybody. And Emma is right, I was nervous about speaking today, and I'll tell you the reason why. I'm slaying a personal dragon. The worst speech I've ever given in my life, I gave in Bermuda to an actuaries institute from the US, and I, for some moronic reason, decided that I would give the entire speech framed around my favourite kids' book, The Little Engine That Could. So it was, do any of you know that story? I think I can. It was all about, you know, the business community in Bermuda and the reinsurance markets. So every single slide I had a really cute picture of a train full of toys, taking toys over the mountain for the kids. And I swear it, I danced and pranced on the stage for 30 minutes and not one person smiled at me. And nobody laughed at any of my jokes. And when I stepped off the stage, nobody clapped. And I was with my CFO. And as I stepped down, he turned to me and he said, "Wow, that was bad." So I'm slaying a personal dragon. I'm going into the actuary's den today. I'm actually delighted to be here, not just to do that, but also because I was running a bank in the reinsurance markets in Bermuda, I have an obsessive and slightly crippling, socially crippling interest in the intersection of reinsurance and banking balance sheets. And that's one of the reasons that I was honoured to go on the Suncorp board, and I don't get to talk to anybody about that except the odd actuary that I come across. So I'm really glad to be in the presence to some extent of some of my tribe. The other piece in terms of being pleased to be here today is this is the first chance I've ever had to actually publicly salute actuaries. You are all doing amazing work with risk management. You're keeping our companies safe, you're keeping our economy safe, and in that way you're contributing to keeping our country safe. And not very many times do you hear people saying that about actuaries rather than making them jokes about it, but making jokes about your profession. So I'm really, really pleased to be here. You're all about risk. And my life and the stories I'm going to tell you this morning are really all around the risk spectrum and where I've sat on the risk spectrum, which you're going to hear, and sometimes has been quite a long way out. But, you know, like all good risk management, it's all about how far out on the spectrum you are and what tools you put in place to make sure that you're not going to fall off the cliff on the other side of it. So my story is a story of risk, and it's also a story of trying to think outside of construct. As Emma was saying, we're living in a world, you know, truth being stranger than fiction, in the world of geopolitical upheaval that Trump is obviously leading us into. We're leading in a world where there's this huge paradox in my mind, which is we're starting to see walls coming up in people's thinking, physically, metaphorically. Walls are coming up everywhere. We're retreating. At the same time, Gen Y and the millennials, and the internet is leading us to be able to drop walls in a way that we have never seen before. And so we have this absolutely paradoxical universe going on, walls coming up and walls coming down. And for me, the Adara journey has really been about that. It's been about, for me, trying to step out of my own intellectual cage, drop down the walls of my own thinking, think across discipline, and try and figure out, is there a better way and a different way to do it that's completely outside of construct? So that's the Adara story. It's a story that I want to tell you today. So to try and summarise very quickly what it is that we actually do, it's actually not that strange, although when we started 20 years ago, it was considered to be, you know, completely out of left field. But we started with one corporate advisory business that I set up in Bermuda for the sole purpose of generating revenue to fund a not-for-profit that I set up at the same time. It's now two corporate advisory businesses, so I'll explain that, and the latest business, which we launched 18 months ago in Australia, in a few minutes. So it's simply a structure where we view our businesses, rather than as businesses to provide return to shareholders, we view our businesses as funding engine for the work of serving people in poverty, particularly women and children, in extreme poverty in the world's most remote places. Some of you who know a wee bit about us will know that we actually were not born as the Adara Group. We were born as the ISIS Group. Yeah. And in fact, I could probably make an entire career out of giving lessons in business schools and marketing schools about what it's like to wake up after 15 years and find your beautiful name being taken by people who are committing absolute atrocities all over the world. I'm very happy to be now talking to you as the founder of the Adara Group. In the last week before we changed our name, I had calls from five different radio show hosts, five shock jocks, who just wanted the fun of saying, I'm about to introduce you to the founder of the ISIS Group. So we were born 20 years ago with a very simple concept, that it would be an incredibly interesting social and business experiment to see what would happen if you employed bankers and corporate finance advisors and gave them the job of going relentlessly into the markets, into the markets to make money, but this time to make it for the disadvantaged, not to the advantaged, and to employ brilliant development specialists and tell them that their job was get up every single day and think about evidence-based best practice service delivery to people in poverty and don't worry about the money. Your mate who's the banker who's sitting right beside you, she's the one who's going to worry about the money. That's what Adara is and ISIS began as. And if I can make this work, I'll show you what that looks like. Hello. Can I flick this cool little machine to the next slide, please? There we go. Our passions. Okay. So what it all boils down to is the things that make us leap out of bed every day. And I can truly say that in 19 years of crying a hell of a lot of tears and making a lot of mistakes along the way, a lot of joy as well and some successes, there has never been a day since I started ISIS, now Adara, where I didn't want to get up and come to work. And the reason for that is I'm incredibly passionate about social justice and human rights, and I'm totally and particularly passionate about these two things. The first thing that we're pretty well known for now worldwide is service delivery, maternal, infant, child health care, but particularly to newborns, preterm babies and low birth weight babies in very, very low resource settings. So places where you don't have consistent electricity supply. And we're amongst the world's leaders now in doing that work. And we're enormously passionate about that. And the second thing that we're pretty well known for is very, very remote service delivery, health and education. And to give you a sense of what I mean by remote, our most remote project is 25 days walk from the nearest road. It's so remote, it's up on the Nepali-Tibetan border, that the dominant marriage order in this community, it's the last place in the world where this marriage order exists, is polyandry. And that means one woman marries a whole group of brothers. A group of brothers take one wife between them. And so that gives you a sense of how remote it is that this social order, which really has died out everywhere else, is still completely intact in this remote, magical and wonderful place. So we're enormously passionate about the work that we do. We touch about 50,000 people a year directly through our service delivery. And on top of that, many, many more through the knowledge sharing pillar that we also run. Now, I'm not doing too well on this. If you can help me, that would be great. Thank you. Okay. All these photos, by the way, are photos from our projects, and of course they all tell the story a million times better than I can. But what I want to do is tell you some of the lessons, some of the things I've learned through all this agony and ecstasy that the Adara journey has been. And just so you know who these kids are in this photograph, people often ask me, do I have kids? And I say, none that I've birthed, but hundreds that I've loved. And these are some of the ones that I have particularly loved. Our remote work took us into the world of child trafficking. Very much surprised me that we ended up working in that area. But because we work so remotely, when the Nepali Civil War happened, it happened, the epicenter of it began in the region that we are the only service provider in. And what happens in war, as many of you know, is the door is open to predators to arrive on the ground and offer to take kids to safety from desperate parents. That's what happened in Nepal. And when the Maoists took over the region that we were in and instituted child soldiering, all of a sudden people were paying everything they had to get at least one child that they could possibly get out to safety and put them into the hands of predators. And these are some of the wee ones that have become a huge part of my life. We discovered 139 of them, and it's a long and joyous story. The littlest ones being three, and in fact, you're not supposed to have favourites when you do this work, but I can tell you that the one sitting on my knee, Paldin, she's my real favourite. She was three when we pulled her out of a basement. So it has been a joyous journey, but it has been a journey of many, many learnings. The first thing I'd say in terms of my learnings and my life is that it has been underpinned by utter gratitude for who I am and the enormous good fortune of being born a Kiwi girl in a country where I never ever woke up and worried, is there food? Am I going to go to school? Am I going to be safe? Am I going to be able to speak my mind? I never worried about that for a second. I was born of people who were wealthy in values, not wealthy in terms of money, but loving, amazing parents who gave me the absolute permission to think outside of the box and speak. And through the Adara journey, there have been these times, you know, that have been really, really hard. There have been a lot of death and disaster. But because my journey has been underpinned with my personal sense of gratitude, everything has unfolded the way that it has, in this beautiful way. I don't know who I would be if I didn't get up every day and was grateful for the life that I've had. Gratitude is the most powerful enabler you can possibly imagine if you want to make change. Hello, I'm going to need another slide. Thank you. The next thing, and I think when they bury me and put something on my grave, I think they'll probably put, bloody hell, that woman was stubborn. Not taking no for an answer has really also been at the core of everything that I've done. I'm 54 now, and I have learnt that when I come up with my next insane idea, the chances of it succeeding and being a great idea directly correlate to how loud the voice of no is when I announce it widely. And that remains true of everything that I have done and am still doing today. This is a picture of me, an extraordinary woman who's still with me, now 19 years ago on my first walk into that really remote region I was talking about, Humla. She's Dr. Kimber Haddocks-McKay. She wrote her PhD on the family systems of the community that I was talking about. She's the only Westerner that's ever lived in this community. When I came up with the idea, I really want to do remote work. It's a human rights issue to me that wherever you're born, you're entitled to the same essential service delivery. The voice of no was astonishing. It was there from the private sector, you know, are you crazy or debt? You know, how are you ever going to be able to afford that? You know, what are you doing? You can't really be running a business to fund a charity. Is it a tax structure? You know, which was really a fair question considering I'd been running a bank in Bermuda. The voice from the non-profit community was, who the hell are you? You ran a bank in Bermuda. What do you know about development work? Get out of our valley. You must be a drug dealer or a money launderer. And the voice from the bilaterals and the government community was, don't go remote. It's too hard. You will never find trained people. You will never be able to afford to sustain it. Even local governments don't go remote. And that beautiful woman up there, Kimber Haddocks, is the one who convinced me otherwise. And in fact, this picture was taken the day after they just stitched my heels. I had to have my heels stitched without anaesthetic to get myself over one of the really big passes. But because I'm born stubborn, I decided I'm not going to take no for an answer, and we're going to do this work. And now we find ourselves really at the heart of amongst the world's great specialists and how on earth you work remotely, even through civil war and extreme poverty. And we're able to share those learnings, all the great stuff we've done and all the mistakes we've made, really, really widely. So not taking no for an answer matters.
Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them, because they change things. They push the human race forward. While some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Perfect for this conference, my favourite ad. Think different. And the message, the learning for me, is that no matter how crazy an idea I've had has been, I have always stood on the shoulders of absolute giants. There are unbelievable people out there, elevated people who have thought outside of the box and who have changed our world. They are smarter, they are more open-minded, they are more spiritually elevated and intellectually ahead than I will ever could dream of being. So every time I doubt myself and worry about what I'm about to do next, I remember that. The next key lesson for me has been all about respect. As a Kiwi girl, to pay my way through university, I was a commercial cleaner. I'm actually a really, really good commercial cleaner, and I walked in here this morning and I could tell, have the cleaners done a great job? I cleaned 5 years every night and one night on the weekends, and I cleaned mostly office buildings, but I've nailed motels, hotels, and I've done a few home cleaning jobs as well. And cleaning for me epitomises the lesson in my life around respect. And I want to tell you one story that sits at the centre of that. So if you can picture me back 30 years ago, scared to say, oh my God, 35 years ago. So I had really, really long hair and it was pink and I was a full-on little social activist and I was cleaning at nights. And when you clean in New Zealand, you're cleaning all these amazing people. They're Samoan, they're Tongan, they're Maori people, and you know, they're all multilingual and they're all putting their kids through school. And they're extraordinary. And so I'm in this huge smock that a Samoan maid of mine has given me, and I've got my long pink hair tied back, and I've got my Walkman in, and I was such a good cleaner that I had what's called a key job, which means they gave you the keys to the office and you could get in outside of office hours. And I had the key job to clean the offices of New Zealand's largest listed company. And so I'm so old that this is back in the day where you're allowed to smoke in the office. Some of you will remember this, what that was like. Most of you won't. But in this particular office, the guy who ran the company was a chain smoker. And not only did he smoke in the office, but he stubbed his cigarette butts out on the carpet beside his desk. Does that tell you everything you need to know about him? And it was such an offensive room that it was just horrifying to have to clean that room every night. So what I would do, my strategy to cope, is I would walk into the offices, go straight to his office, slam the door and clean the rest of the place, and then I'd do his last. So I didn't have to carry the energy of that man's room, his office, his piggishness, that for the whole time that I was in the office. Anyway, here I am this one particular night and I'm cleaning away with my vacuum, and all of a sudden there's a tap on my shoulder. And I turn around, and it's this guy, it's the CEO. And so, you know, lo, the pig appears. So he's working late. So I take out my earbuds, and I said, yes. And he said, you, girl, you, come here, follow me. And I said, okay. And so I put my stuff down, and he took me into the men's, executive men's toilets. And he took me in there, and we walked to the, up to the urinal, and he pointed at the urinal, and he said to me, "You see that girl? You see that? You always miss that." And then he turned on his heels and he walked out. And I swear it, that man would not have recognised me or remembered me 30 seconds later if he'd walked past me in the street. But I never forgot him. And so now we're going to roll forward 5 years, and I'm with big English law firm Linklaters and Paynes, and I'm in Hong Kong, and I'm appointed by a group of lead banks to fly back to New Zealand to refinance the global debt of the very same company. True story. So now I'm no longer the girl who misses the urinal. I'm the girl who's in charge of their financial future. And the very first meeting I go into, I kid you not, is with the board of directors. And I walk in the room and they all rise as one to greet me, as everybody does to the bank's lawyers. And the first guy to put his hands out, I am not kidding, Mr. Urinal. The message is, respect everybody. It's great values to respect everybody. But on top of that, you never ever know where people are going to turn up later on in your life. Next thing for me is about standing up for what you believe in. I cut my teeth as a social activist in New Zealand during the Springbok tour. As you know, we have one religion in New Zealand. It's called rugby union. And when the Springboks were brought to New Zealand, in contravention of the apartheid boycott, our country divided. 500,000 New Zealanders went out on the streets. We protested every week, twice a week, for 90 days while the Springboks were there. And it was actually a very, very violent and frightening time and divisive time in our country's history. And every time I would go out and stand up on the streets for what I believed in as a young university student, people would be throwing bottles at us from the pubs and yelling, "Go back to where you came from." It was a really frightening time. But during that period, I realised while I was standing arm in arm with people from all races and walks of life that if you don't stand up for what you believe in, who are you really? And it stood with me. My activist roots have stood with me the whole way through my career. I believe profoundly that we have to stand up for what we believe in. The next thing that I've learned is that to stand up for what you believe in, sometimes you have to step out of your tribe. So my story is a story of coming. I actually came to Australia to jump in the Australian National Parachute Champs. I was, as well as being obsessively interested in balance sheets, I was for 15 years an obsessively keen skydiver. And I came to Australia to jump in the Aussie National Parachute Champs and busted my knee, so I had to go and finish my law degree at Melbourne University. And for the first time, I was amongst students who not only were not cleaning offices and houses at night to make money, they drove to school in their cars. And I had a really big aha moment during that period of my life when I was in Melbourne at Melbourne Uni, where I realised, oh my God, I don't understand money. I don't understand power. How am I ever going to affect social change unless I understand that? And so I made a huge decision, and I actually owe a particular partner of Minter Ellison's enormous debt of gratitude for this, because I was cleaning his house and I went home this particular night to his house, and he came in and I said, "What's the most right-wing law firm in Australia?" And he said, "I beg your pardon?" And I said, "Oh, I mean, what's the most business-friendly law firm?" And he gave me a gift that I have to say a lot of people have given me in their lives. He said to me, "It's a firm in Sydney called Allen Allen and Hemsley, but you would never get in there." And so when I began my M&A career at Allen's, 6 months later, I stepped right out of my tribe. And for the first time in my life, I put on a pair of high heels, cut my hair, put makeup on, and I went into the dark side as a feminist activist, human rights, social justice warrior. And of course, when you do that, when you step out of your tribe, suddenly you wake up and you realise, oh my God, I've been so prejudiced. And I got into the world of M&A. This was early 80s, M&A boom time. I wasn't fit to serve the coffee, but instead here I was on the best deals happening in Australia. You know, it was M&A, structured finance. It was so much fun. And I realized once I was in that world, these people are great and they have values too and they have intellect and they want to affect change too. And I have been utterly and completely prejudiced. And so my journey has been one of constantly stepping outside of my tribe and being able ultimately to try and find a way, in a small way, to express that if we don't bridge divide, if we don't stop thinking down train tracks, we're never actually going to affect change. The reason that the slide is up in relation to this issue is because once you step out of your tribe, you realize there's a whole lot of different ways and out-of-construct ways to do things. And, you know, when I was a social activist, my placard-bearing days, and I have to say I still do a fair bit of that, but in terms of thinking, I thought in the old days that that was what great social activism was. And when I thought about how to change the world, you know, I realised, you know, you can be Banksy, you can do the most brilliant graffiti in the world, you could be Malala, you could be Snowden, but I wasn't going to be any of those things. And then the business community was, you could be Milton Friedman and believe that there is only one stakeholder and it's the shareholder. And I realised there's another way to think, and that actually I could use the power of banking to affect social change. And so I decided that I was going to become a banking social activist. And I realised that if you want to think out a construct, you have to create models that matter. So this is the latest business that we launched. We launched it 18 months ago, and it's called Adara Partners. And you can see I'm standing by a whole lot of really famous people there. I still laugh when I look at this photograph because I never, ever in my wildest dreams thought David Gonski and Matthew Grounds, who runs UBS, Guy Fowler, who runs the investment bank of UBS, Catherine Brenner, Alana Atlas, the chair of Coke, that these people would become part of Adara. But because I started to think about models and bridging divide and creating new constructs, I came up with an idea to give corporate advice by offering investment bankers and really senior business people the chance to use their mastery for purpose for the first time ever. And I went to investment bankers and said, how do you like to run an M&A deal and know that all the fees are going to go to people in poverty? And I created a business with a panel. And I now have a panel of 16 of Australia's most famous investment bankers. And the panel are all authorised reps on my licence. We have a full Australian Financial Services licence. And together they co-lead mandates in the corporate advisory markets for me. So the first deal we did, and we're allowed to use their name, was for Wesfarmers. And it was run by David Gonski and Matthew Grounds. And my core banking team worked underneath them. So I have created a model, and we're only 18 months out of the box. I'm not entirely boasting yet, but I will be boasting in about a year's time when I know that we've really cracked this model. But we've created a model, we've done multiple mandates, we've generated $3 million for our work from a standing start in 18 months, and we have engaged the most prominent people in the financial services sector. At the moment, we're giving advice as independent advisor on an IPO. We are on multiple federal and state government tenders. We negotiated the broadcast rights for the Football Federation of Australia. So we're working at the heart of the great deals of Australia, but the leaders of the deals working together are working pro bono. So that's the latest model. And after 19 years of thinking about how you sit in the intersection of profit and purpose, this is, I hope, going to be my greatest contribution. And if we make this work, then we are going to take it into New York and we are going to take it to London and Hong Kong, not for Adara, but for the model and the construct for vulnerable people. And can you imagine how great it will be if all over the world it's the most prestigious thing in the planet, if you're an investment banker, to run a deal across your competitive boundaries, at least one a year for a couple of years, where all the proceeds, all the fees of that go to people in poverty. Models really, really matter. Mistakes matter too. When you're working with vulnerable client groups, it's not a game. It's not agile and lean. And we come with arrogance from the private sector to believing that we know the answers to other people's problems. And as I talked about before, I've made a huge number of mistakes. In fact, I could stand here talking about them. You could all go out to morning tea and lunch, dinner, come back, I'd still be standing here. But I want to explain the gravity of mistakes when you're working with the vulnerable. And for me, there are three little kids that sit on my shoulder every single day. The biggest mistake that I have ever made in this work was when we started to get into preterm babies' health work, tertiary level healthcare in remote places, and we got our first three incubators. Don't know, have any of you ever had a preemie? Some of you must know NICU work. You have NICU work and preemie work. So babies, little wee babies, they can't thermoregulate, or they have problems thermoregulating. So we got into this work and we got our first three incubators, and it was like, I felt like Santa Claus. We delivered them into the hospital that we work in Uganda, and it was just such an exciting thing. That literally, they were ripping the cardboard off and stuffing babies in them. It was extraordinary. But because I rushed, I had not thought about the fact that the power supply was inconsistent. And 10 nights later, in the middle of the night, I woke up and we have little houses in the hospital, and it was deadly silent. And I realized the power had gone down. And three babies suffocated to death in our first incubators within 10 days of putting them in. Mistakes really, really matter. And we need to talk about them and share them so other people don't make the same mistakes. It's a very, very deep thing, a deep responsibility when you interfere in the lives of the vulnerable. Let me just go back. Believing in people, including yourself. This is an incredible woman. Actually, I'm going to end shortly with her to show you her, let you meet her in person. But what I have learned is it's amazing. You can be a Kiwi girl that just has a mad idea, and you can do things that really take the next step forward, that put a jewel in the mosaic of change. But it's all about self-belief and making sure that what you do, you really do as well and as intently and seriously as possible. In fact, I've got a slide before that that we may have missed. Let me just see if I can bring it up. Be contrarian. Have I got enough time to show you this? Sorry, but I just want to show you what this all comes down to. I think my whole life is going to come down to a bottle and a tube. So everybody told us, no, don't do tertiary. It's too hard. Don't do remote. It's too hard. And we said, bugger you, we're going to try it anyway because it really matters. If you're a preterm or a low birth weight baby, one of the problems you have is your lungs aren't fully developed and you can't quite suck enough air in. So in the West, there's a $15,000 service delivery, continuous positive airway pressure, where little tiny wee babies have all these amazing tests and they get their lungs inflated just as they need to allow them to be able to get breath. And to give you a sense of the statistics around this, about 1 million babies a year die of respiratory distress in the first 24 hours of life. That's the size of the prize. We've spent 18 years going incredibly deep on how on earth can you deliver air and oxygen to a newborn when you don't have a consistent power supply. And it all comes down to a bottle and a tube. This is an early stage CPAP machine. We've been working with this for years and years. You fill the bottle up with water, you score the baby, you sync the tube to the number score that you've come up with, and when you bubble the oxygen out of an oxygen cylinder through it, because it bubbles through water, it changes the pressure and it goes up your tiny wee preemie baby's nose. So we've managed to crack that, but for years we've been trying to figure out how you blend air into oxygen. Because if you give a newborn pure oxygen, because oxygen cylinders don't require electricity, if you give them pure oxygen, they can get oxygen toxicity. Their wee eyeballs aren't fully developed either, and if their eyeballs bleed, they go blind. So Stevie Wonder is the most famous preemie in the world that was given pure oxygen. So we've been working on this forever and ever and ever. Well, people told us, no, 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 too hard. And let me see if I can put this gorgeous little baby down here for a second and show you the final piece of this. Can you see this? This is a 3D printed blender. So 2 years ago, a medical innovation group outside of Seattle, we've got offices, clinical practice offices in Seattle, found us and teamed up with us. And together, we have come up with this idea of this. This has the same principle, works on the same principle as the Mars space rover. And as the oxygen bubbles pass through that, it sucks in ambient air. We think it's the first in the world way to blend air and oxygen without electricity. And we're now going into clinical trials. Harvard are part of this program, Seattle Children's, University of Washington, PATH, who are the medical innovator. We're the expert implementer, and over the next 18 months we're running trials, and we think this is so powerful that it may change the WHO protocol on delivery of blended air and oxygen to newborns. The whole kit, about $15 we reckon. You can print it and put it together in country. So be contrarian, I guess, is my final message. Now let me end by showing you, by bringing this to life and introducing you to one of my great heroes, Sister Christine, who stood by us as we've built all this incredible work. And I just ask you to think while you're watching this video what it feels like to run an M&A, an investment banking deal, and have this kind of outcome.
So When I started working in Chuoko, we didn't have NICU facilities. Reason why the hospital was just being started and it was being built up, and we had only maternity. And by then, the first maternity we had, the maternity had about 8 beds, and we were very few actually, and we couldn't do much. Not until when ISIS came up to the hospital and brought the idea of introducing the NICU ward, and the NICU ward began in 2002. First NICU, we had two small rooms, which looked like a sitting room and a bedroom. So the first room, we could admit babies from our maternity here, the babies who had any problems during early neonatal age, like hypoglycemia, hypothermia. We had even the premature babies in that unit. And then the other room, we could nurse babies from the community, and people got to know more about the NICU ward in Chuoko Hospital. They began bringing in their babies, and more babies came in from the community and other health facilities. So when these babies came in, we had the care to give them, and they began improving, and we saved many neonatals. The NICU of today, we moved in 2010 May. That was when it was opened, and it is more spacious by then. We had enough room, but also as time went on, within the 2 years, we began having many babies. Our babies could reach the number 20, 27, 30, and we have enough equipment right now. That was what we actually needed. That was our dream, to have enough space so that we could have more babies. And right now, that's what is going on. We have more babies, and more babies are getting saved. And the new NICU has actually improved the neonatal health. So we are really very grateful for the people who are supporting the NICU. And also, we are happy because we are saving the newborn lives.
Thank you so much.